Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Timothy Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Hello, welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm Dr. Tim Jennings, and I'm joined today by Chad Richard, our CEO here at the clinic. And today we're going to be talking about the importance of sleep and maybe some things that interfere with sleep and maybe some myths that people have about sleep.
So sleep is a topic that we're frequently asked about, and it's so pervasive in how we function, our immune system, our mental health. Help us understand some of the most frequently encountered challenges that you've seen in your practice over 36 years and how those kind of contribute to or potentially cause some other issues that people may be having.
So I think first let's talk about what sleep is and what normal sleep and maybe some misconceptions about sleep, and we can get into maybe some of the details about the struggles that people have that interfere. Many people don't realize that sleep is one of the physiological requirements for health and life. Mm. And we need air, water, food, and sleep to be healthy. It's a requirement. And if we're deficient, chronically deficient in sleep, which at least one third of Americans are chronically deficient.
Wow.
Then they have not only fatigued brain, their brain isn't getting the rest it needs, but their body isn't getting the restorative opportunity to repair from all day's work. Normal hormone releases, their resilience is down. They will have a vulnerability to a whole host of physical and health problems if they're chronically sleep deprived. They have higher rates of risk of dementias, they age. Mm. So lots of cascading problems with chronic sleep difficulty.
And severe ones.
Yes, very significant. And people just do not feel as well if they're not getting good sleep. But there's a lot of myths about sleep. First off, sleep for the brain is when body is repairing, the brain is repairing, clearing out byproducts of metabolism, building out new networks, memory consolidation. So all the things you're doing during the day, you're learning, so forth, using brain energy. And so at night, the trash cleaners come along, clean out the garbage, the trash, the byproducts of metabolism. The builders come along, make new networks. And so if you've been training as an athlete, you've been studying as a student, at night, your brain is building out what you've been telling it to do, so you will actually be more proficient, have better memory the next day than before you did it. In fact, this is where many young people don't understand the importance of sleep in relationship to memory and study. Mm. They will do an all-nighter before an exam, which will undermine their score. A study done on college students related to sleep and memory, they took a group of college students, randomized into two groups, had both groups memorize made-up words. There was made-up words because we didn't want people's baseline vocabulary to affect the study. So made-up words with made-up definitions. Mm-hmm. And they would memorize this list of words and definitions, both groups. And they tested both groups right after the memorization period was over. And then they let one group go home and sleep the night. They kept the other group awake all night. Then they brought them both back and tested them the next day. And not only did the group who slept score better than the group who didn't sleep, the group who slept scored better than they themselves did right after the memorization period.
Wow.
Okay. So many college students don't know this. They want to pull an all-nighter so they can cram it all in. No, you want to study and you want to get a good night's sleep. You will have better memory, better retention, better performance than if you pull an all-nighter, because it is during the night that your brain is actually building out the pathways and storing the memories and connecting the links. And you need that brain structure, those networks, in order to actually perform well. Without that, you're trying to hold it just in your short-term memory, not your long-term pathways. So that's a first element, I think, on sleep that people misunderstand.
Wow.
Understanding this big principle of building and connecting, this is why infants, young adults need more sleep than the adult, the full-grown adult. Because the infant comes into the world at birth with millions of neurons more at birth than that brain will have by the time it's 8 years of age. First 8 years of life, the brain is busy killing off neurons because the brain comes in basically as a blank slate. Mm-hmm. Many people think, oh, that's terrible, I need those neurons. No, think about Michelangelo's block of marble when Michelangelo gets it, and Michelangelo's block of marble when he's done with it. Mm. When he's done, he has less marble, but he has a masterpiece. So the brain comes into the world prepared to be acted upon by life experiences, education, and neural circuits which are being used will expand and develop like your language circuits as you're an infant growing up. Neural circuits which are not used are pruned back and reassigned. And so children come into the world with a brain capable of learning and assimilating and building. And so there's lots of remodeling, lots of structuring. So they need more sleep for the brain to build those pathways and also clear out all those byproducts. Mm-hmm. So infants will sleep 16, 18 hours a day, and babies will sleep 12, 14 hours a day, and young children will sleep 10, 12 hours a day, and young adolescents 9 to 11 hours a day, and so forth, and because the brain is still remodeling, okay? Mm-hmm. And then once you become an adult, the most adult brains need between 7 and 8 hours of sleep a night for the maintenance of the brain. But this is why, students, schools don't, in school zones or municipalities where the schools start real early in the morning for the kids, they don't do as well because they're actually undermining the actual physiological sleep the brain needs. And so when school starts, say, at 7 a.m. and the kids are having to get up at 5 a.m. to get the school bus, okay, it's actually interfering with the hours of sleep the brain needs and the kids don't do as well. They have more behavior problems. They don't score as well.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow. That is fascinating.
Yeah.
I never made that connection.
Yeah. So that's just one aspect of sleep. And as you get older, you can tolerate that. But depending on the age range, you need more sleep for the brain to actually prepare itself for what you've done the night before. And so maybe next talk about what is normal sleep. And most people have this fiction that they think normal sleep is you go to sleep at a certain time and you sleep 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 hours, whatever your age appropriate sleep is, and you wake up many hours later. No human brain sleeps that way. Mm. Okay, normal sleep is when you fall asleep, you go into a very light stage. Mm. It's called stage one sleep. This is when grandma falls asleep on the couch in Thanksgiving afternoon and she starts to snore and the kids go, "Grandma, you're snoring. I wasn't even asleep yet." Okay, all right. That is such a light stage that you're in sleep, but if somebody wakes you, you don't believe you've been asleep yet.
Interesting.
It's super light. It's only a few minutes, just a few minutes, maybe 3, 7, 10 minutes, something like that. Just short. And then you go into stage two sleep. Certain things happen there. And then you go into the deep, slow wave sleep. That's where your body temperature falls, your heart rate falls, your muscles repair, memories consolidate. Mm. And then you go into REM, rapid eye movement sleep, where you do your dreaming. Mm. And then you wake up. And then you go back into stage one, two, deep sleep, REM, wake up. Stage one, two, deep sleep, REM, wake up, all through the night. Now, when we're young or really physically exhausted, those wake ups between the end of REM and the next stage one may be 3, 5 seconds. You wake up just enough, but you're in a waking state, you're not in a sleep state. You shift, turn in the bed, but you don't register it. So there's no memory of waking up. And so you have the myth or belief, I slept without waking up.
Mm.
But you actually had, as far as the brain is concerned, a brief wake up.
Because there's a full cycle.
Yeah, full cycle. Well, yeah, but you actually leave the sleeping state and your brain waves at that point are in a waking state.
Mm.
Okay. And many people, though, when we get older now, they'll have these slight cycles and now they'll wake up, bladder call, arthritic pain, back hurting, and they now get up, go to the bathroom, and they remember now they're waking up and they start thinking, I'm not sleeping good. I'm waking up 2 or 3 times a night now. I didn't used to do that. I need to take a medication. No, if your wake-ups are natural on your own, which is meaning the dog is not waking you up, the train is not waking you up. In other words, some alarms aren't waking you up. If you're being awakened in the middle of the cycle, that is no good. If your wake-ups are natural at the end of your own REM cycle, there's actually no negative consequence to that at all. And if you medicate it, it'll almost always alter your sleep structure. And most medications for sleep, not all, interfere with sleep architecture and memory consolidation.
Mm.
Even most of the over-the-counter ones.
Yeah.
And if you take them chronically, many of them, and I'm not going to list them, but many sleep meds can increase your risk of dementia as you age if you take them chronically because the physiological cascade of what it's doing. So in my practice, I have a ton of patients who are stressed that they're not sleeping because of these wake-ups, and they've been using over-the-counter medicines when I educate them, and they just simply say, you know, as long as you're able to get back to sleep in a reasonable amount of time, and an adult brain needs typically about 5 of those. Oh, by the way, the time you enter the stage one to the time you exit and wake up is anywhere between 70 and 120 minutes for most people.
Interesting.
So a little over an hour to 2 hours, you're waking up multiple times a night, you're able to get back to sleep, you get 7 to 8 hours of total sleep, you're fine. That's the first thing. Stop stressing, stop worrying, total sleep. It's not the problem of waking up. Secondly, many people, I might be up for an hour, 2 hours in the night. Okay, how much total sleep did you get though? 7, 8 hours. You're fine. You don't need to medicate that. What? What history shows us is that prior to electricity, and you can go back and look at historical records, the typical human being before electricity would sleep in two bouts each night. They would sleep from sunset for 3 to 4 hours. They would get up, turn on lamps, lights, do things around the house for a couple of hours and go back to sleep for 3 to 4 hours and get up around 5 in the morning or 6 in the morning when the sun comes up. And so there's two bouts, the first and the second bout. People are often up in the middle of the night doing things in their homes. And this is how, and there's even cultures where they don't have electricity, and that's how the tribal people still pretty much sleep in two bouts, okay?
And
what's happened with electricity is you stayed up longer, and so you've consolidated into a 7-8 hour sleep single bout. But that's not how it is. So even I've had an occasional patient that they sleep that way. They'll sleep for 3 to 4 hours. They'll go to sleep about 7, get up around 11, and then they will be up till 2 in the morning. They'll go back to sleep till 5 or 6 in the morning. Perfectly fine. There's no physiological problem from that.
Wow. That's really helpful. And probably comforting for a lot of people who are experiencing that.
Yeah.
So what about all the people who I've heard over the years say, you know, hey, alcohol makes me sleep better.
Okay.
And I'm sure you've heard that one many times.
And it's a myth. Alcohol will sedate someone until they fall asleep, but alcohol actually interferes with normal sleep architecture. You won't go through the same cycles. You actually get less sleep. You get less restorative sleep. It interferes with memory consolidation, causes dehydration, a lot of problems with drinking to try to sleep. And you ultimately get tolerance to it because your brain doesn't want to be sedated by alcohol. So the brain will change. And so the same amount typically will not get you the same effect. So you keep upping the dose.
Wow. Wow. So, and does that hold true, I imagine, for the people who say, yeah, but I just have one drink, or I have two drinks rather than, you know.
There is no healthy amount of alcohol, period. The data is pretty clear now. Any amount of alcohol causes health problems, whether it's sleep problems, immune problems. 1 ounce of alcohol impairs your immune system, your lymphocytes for up to 12 hours after that drink. Lymphocytes are what monitor your system for cancer cells that emerge. And therefore, the data is very clear. Any amount of alcohol at all, you have increased cancer risk in life. Yeah. So there's no healthy amount of alcohol.
I'm really encouraged actually by what I'm seeing just in my personal social circles around the use of alcohol. And I feel like it is diminishing significantly. And culturally, you see that, and you even see that in the market research data about industry trends and overall volumes of alcohol that are being consumed, they are declining. Now, I think in many cases, that may be offset by other things that people are using that are, you know, whether it's marijuana or vaping, and we can either choose to cover that topic now, or we can come back at another one. I mean, I would love if you have any brief thoughts just around marijuana and the debate that's going on there related to, well, you know, it's legal in my state, and so it can't be harmful for me.
So that type of thinking is childish. Mm. States can pass laws to make things legal.
Like cigarettes.
Cigarettes, tobacco, alcohol, marijuana, they can pass laws to make things legal. States can never pass laws to make things healthy. Mm. They can't do it. Those are God's laws. The laws of health are the laws upon which life operates. Things either are healthy or not healthy. Mm. If your state, and so anybody who says that, I would say to them, if your state passes a law that says poison ivy salads are legal, are you going to start eating them?
Right.
Why not?
Great question.
Why not? It's legal. Why not? Or it's already legal. There's no law against it. Why don't you do it? Okay.
Right.
Because, well, it's stupid. That's what foolishness is. Foolishness actually is doing things that are knowingly and understandably harmful and injurious. Mm. It's foolish to do that. Well, that's what marijuana is. Marijuana is neurotoxic. There is no health benefit. And I will say this, and I don't care what mental health professional out there is prescribing marijuana, there is no justification of any kind to prescribe marijuana for mental health problems. Mm. Prescribing marijuana for mental health problems is exactly functionally like 100 years ago in America when doctors did this, prescribed cigarettes for lung disease. And they did for at least 50 years, cigarettes were prescribed for lung disease in America.
Wow.
And why? And let me explain why. Because when you smoke a cigarette, you get nicotine. Nicotine immediately, the immediate effect will cause the musculature in the bronchial to constrict. And so that's the nicotine. And when the bronchial is constricted, it opens the airways and you go, oh, it's helping me breathe. I can move air easier. So it does as an immediate effect to open airways. But it also is delivering toxins and poisons that destroy the alveoli, called emphysema, cause lung cancer. It's actually killing you, okay? Mm-hmm. Marijuana has an immediate intoxicating effect, which causes you to have this euphoric, relaxed, relaxing kind of buzz, and you feel emotionally better at some, mm-hmm. while at the same time, it is damaging your neurons and damaging your glia, interfering with memory consolidation, worsening your brain health. And the data is very clear. It increases basically every mental health problem, depression, anxiety, psychosis. Mm-hmm. But marijuana today, people need to understand, marijuana today is not the marijuana of the 1960s and 70s and 80s. The marijuana of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s was a natural plant, basically. And it had 3 to 5% THC. That's the chemical you get a buzz from. And it also had a substantial amount of cannabidiol, CBD. And the marijuana plant has at least 160 or more psychoactive chemicals that have never been studied. Mm. But those two have been studied. THC gives you a buzz. CBD has the potential medical benefits, neuroprotective. CBD, you cannot get any buzz from it, has no sense of physical, I feel better from it, but it has neuroprotective effects. Mm. The marijuana of the 60s, 70s, and 80s had 3 to 5% THC and reasonable amounts of CBD, so you can get the buzz. Still, that may be not healthy, but because of all the other things you're putting into your lungs when you're smoking smoke, okay? Mm. But the CBD was somewhat neuroprotective. Today's marijuana, and cannabis products that are sold, not the CBD oil, which is, if it's pure, it's just CBD oil. That's fine. It's just pure CBD. Nobody wants just the pure CBD oil because you can't feel anything from it. Mm. If you're looking for a feel and you use CBD oil, it feels like water. It feels nothing, but it may have a protective benefit. But the marijuana today has anywhere from 12 to 30% THC.
Mm. Wow.
Okay. And how do you get more THC? Well, you have to have more of the THC producing genes in the genome of the plant. And there's a limited landscape. How do you get more copies of that gene? You have to cut out something so you can put that in. What do they cut out? The CBD genes. So the marijuana is high THC, low CBD. It's highly neurotoxic. It's very harmful.
Mm.
Okay. Wow. And then if you're actually a critical thinker, you'll watch and all of the data, you'll see all this industry produced data about how it's got this clinical effect or this protective effect that will always be based on the CBD data.
Mm.
But they'll do the old switcheroo and they'll do something in the plant with high CBD, but then they'll switch out and sell you the stuff with the high THC, which, because that's what people want. They want to get the buzz. They want to get that. And they want to get the buzz and high and believe they're not hurting themselves. It's a big scam. It's a fraud. It's damaging, it's harmful, and states can pass laws to make it legal, but the people passing these laws to make it legal are not interested in your health, they're not interested in your welfare, they're interested in making money or political power.
Yeah.
Okay?
And I think I've seen some data as well regarding fatal traffic accidents and the presence of, the common presence of THC in the blood in fatal.
You should do a little online search and ask, give me the data on mass shootings and marijuana use.
Mm.
I think there's a study, I have a paper looking at this, and essentially every major mass shooting that has happened, the person doing it was a heavy marijuana user.
Wow.
Pretty much. So at least in the study I looked at, this was the high correlation between that, and it is suppressed information. They want to focus on the guns rather than focusing on the marijuana because the people behind the, the let's stop the guns to stop it are the same people. Let's make marijuana more available because if you look at financial interests and impacts on society, you can see the political forces moving to switch our society in these directions. But probably the bigger driver is we've had guns available for a long time in America and we didn't have this. What's the big change is we're making marijuana more toxic, more accessible, and therefore people are becoming, less, their prefrontal cortex is damaged. They have less inhibition. They get more paranoid, more psychotic, and they're more willing to make these irrational decisions.
Wow. That's incredible. So Dr. Jennings, does that mean that sleep can have an impact on anxiety, anger, negative emotions, and can those feelings be stronger when we're exhausted? Is there any correlation there?
100%. So when you're sleep deprived, the part of the brain that is most negatively affected is your prefrontal cortex. That's where you think, reason, plan, problem solve, self-restrain. And when that part of the brain is underactive, then and self-restraint modulates and works through your moods and so forth. And when that's underactive, then you become more disinhibited. You have more vulnerability to acting out in various ways. Mm. Examples, when somebody gets intoxicated with alcohol, the prefrontal cortex is impaired. They become then disinhibited. Mm. And somebody who's drunk may take their top off, who may get up on a bar table and dance and sing. They would never do that if they were not drunk. That the prefrontal cortex judgment becomes disinhibited and impulses are more likely to be expressed, okay? Another example of the job of the prefrontal cortex, if you're getting on the interstate and somebody cuts you off and you get an impulsive urge to say an ugly word, okay, that's coming out of your emotion mood circuits. But if you go, no, maybe I'm a Christian, and maybe they have a pregnant wife, they're trying to get to the hospital, and you restrain yourself, that's your prefrontal cortex. Impairing prefrontal cortex disinhibits those urges, and this is where you get the road rage and so forth. So a sleep-deprived person would be much more likely to respond with anger and rage than a non-sleep-deprived person, or an intoxicated person, anger and rage, than a non-intoxicated person. So anything that impairs prefrontal cortex, and this is why I advise couples, if you have, a major marital issue to discuss, the time to discuss it is not at night before you go to bed, because this is when your brain is most fatigued. Even if you're a normal sleeper, you've worked all day, your brain is tired, it's now ready for rest, it's not able. And so I advise couples, if one of them brings up something that's of quite significant distress, to say to your spouse, I love you so much, what you brought up is absolutely important to me. It needs to be discussed, but you deserve my whole brain, not half my brain. And right now, my prefrontal cortex, my thinking circuit is fatigued, and I will likely only become overwhelmed and irritable. Let me sleep on. Let's talk about it in the morning.
Wow, that's really helpful.
And you will get a much better outcome. And so, yes, sleep deprivation makes people much more vulnerable to aggression, rage, acting out, loss of impulse control. It also is directly correlated to error rates. Exxon Valdez. Remember Exxon Valdez?
Yes.
What was the primary contributing cause? The captain was sleep deprived.
Wow.
And he was asleep at the wheel, basically, and or not paying attention. And this is also with medical errors that happen when doctors are working the long super shifts without sleep. There's a direct correlation to high medical errors. And so lots of things have been done structurally to try to minimize that. And one of the things that with the technology of internet and access, that there's certain hospital systems now have contracted with like radiologists in Australia at the nighttime hours here, which is daytime hours there, that imaging comes in, it gets transmitted there, and they do the reading of the imagery down there, and then and their radiologists here read their images during their sleep hours there. So you're always having, alert and oriented people, not waking the radiologists up in the middle of the night who's half asleep and might miss something.
Right.
Or keeping them up all night. So there's things like that that are going on, and it's well documented.
So let's explore that. Can you tell us a little more about what happens inside the brain when we don't get enough sleep?
The primary thing is that you're fatigued and your circuits aren't able to keep up with what you're doing. So your brain is not able to process information as efficiently because you're tired and fatigued. That's the primary thing. I don't know if there's anything special going on inside the brain when you're tired, other than you're not cleaning. I mean, so during brain, so when you say going on when you're sleep deprived, okay, you're more inflamed. When you get normal sleep, the brain uses 20% of the body's energy. The brain is 1% to 2% of the body size. 1% to 2% uses 20% of the body's energy.
Wow.
So it's highly metabolic, using lots of energy, and that makes waste products. During sleep, the actual brain cells contract and expel from the inside of the brain cell the waste products of metabolism into the cerebral spinal fluid to be cleared out of the brain. Chronic sleep deprivation interferes with this clearing process. So then you can build up byproducts of metabolism in the brain over years of chronic sleep deprivation that then increase your risk of oxidative stress on the brain, dementia, and other problems.
Wow. Okay. So that explains, I think, a little bit around why sleep deprivation can really mimic the effects of alcohol, as you mentioned earlier.
Of course it does. Yes, it does. And in fact, drivers are just as impaired with sleep deprivation as they are when they're intoxicated.
Wow.
The impairments are the same.
That has
been measured.
I've seen some clinical data. Mm-hmm. Yes. Wow. So I think you mentioned earlier, sleep deprivation can actually weaken willpower and self-control, like the inhibitions, similar to alcohol. Is that an accurate statement?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So in that same vein, I'm guessing temptation, cravings, decision-making, all similarly affected?
That's all prefrontal cortex stuff, yes. So you are more vulnerable to irritability, to snapping, to things getting on your nerves and reacting inappropriately. So if you're sleep deprived and you're going to a committee meeting that you've got a couple people that are always on your nerves, you're probably not going to have a good meeting.
Right. Well,
unless you sleep through it.
Yeah. Okay, great. Probably not the best option, but one option for sure. So if someone has chronic sleep deprivation, is that something that you've seen as a contributing factor to depression?
Sure, absolutely. Yes, that is a known factor. If you're chronically sleep deprived, you have a higher risk of depression than if you're not. And so one of the things we want to do is we want to restore people to normal amounts of sleep, and other sleep disorders increase that. For instance, sleep disorder called obstructive sleep apnea.
Mm.
Obstructive sleep apnea is when you're asleep, the soft tissues in the back of your mouth, your tongue and so forth, will cover the windpipe. The diaphragm tries to move air, but the windpipe is covered, so you can't move air. And then your blood oxygen level falls. And as your blood oxygen level falls, then your alert mechanism in your brainstem, you're suffocating, awakens you just enough that you tighten up the musculature and you get a breath, and you're basically out of, in and out of light stages of sleep. You don't go through the whole sleep cycle all night. And you're hypoxic in and out of through the night. And this is a known factor that contributes directly to depression. You treat the sleep apnea, the depression improves. Additionally, people who are chronically have chronic obstructive sleep apnea that's not treated, we actually see shrinkage in certain brain areas. Gray matter is lost in certain brain areas. When you treat their sleep apnea, that returns. And so you would want to evaluate whether somebody actually has a sleep disorder or not and then treat it appropriately.
Wow, that's helpful. Very informative. I had not ever made that connection between those two, but I'm sure a lot of our viewers probably will have those questions or maybe have those conditions.
And I take the position with our patients, if they have known sleep apnea and it's significant, it's diagnosed, and they have depression, all bets are off. We can't treat their depression until they get their sleep because it'd be like saying to somebody who has a plastic bag over their head and they haven't actually passed out and died yet, but they're not feeling well. I give me something to help me feel well. Not until you get the plastic bag off your head. Okay. I mean, you're out of harmony with one of the physiological requirements for life and health, and all bets are off until, and then some people will have sleep apnea and they're not, and they know they're waking up all night because they're not breathing and they want something to sedate them. How can I sedate you when you're going to maybe suffocate more?
Right.
Okay. So you've got to actually prioritize the important things. We've had a few patients even come to the clinic that we've diagnosed with bad sleep apnea, and we send them home. You've got to get that treated before we can actually do anything here.
Interesting. Thank you. That's helpful. So I know, you know, just thinking back to my life through school or early career, I think a lot of people have really glorified the ability to function on little sleep. And they say, oh, I've trained my body to function on only 4 hours or 6 hours of sleep a night. Is that possible?
No, that's myth. You can't do it. They may think that they can still get awake, they can still do things, but their functional impairment is down. They won't have the same quality of function. They will make more mistakes. They might be more irritable. They might snap off. They might be more impulsive. If they're high IQ, they might still be able to do stuff because, you know, a high IQ person, it's like having a high-speed internet. They have high bandwidth, so they can process a lot of information very quickly, so they don't actually need to stay with a problem very long to get the solution. Mm-hmm. If you're an average IQ or struggling there, then you will actually, your deficiencies will be manifest much sooner. So a high IQ person might appear to function just as well as everybody else, but they're not functioning at their maximum if they're chronically sleep deprived.
And that doesn't take into consideration all the physical, the dementia risk, the
correct,
all the other, the depression risk. I mean, the list, it was very long of what we've covered.
Correct. Additionally, people, will often use caffeine, thinking caffeine gives energy.
Yeah, let's talk about caffeine.
Caffeine does not give energy. Caffeine interferes with the brain signal that you need sleep. Bottom line, when you burn energy through the day, I don't know if you wanted me to go through the specifics of what's happening.
Yes, please.
On a cellular level, energy comes from those little molecules, remember from high school, inside the cells called ATP. Your mitochondria make ATP. Adenosine tri, like a tri-signal, three triphosphates. Adenosine molecule, three phosphates. And it goes through something called the Krebs cycle. Mm-hmm. And as it burns up energy, as it releases a phosphate, that gives cellular energy. Your cells have energy to work, and you feel vitality, and you feel alert, and you feel motivated. This is cellular energy, ATPs. And it goes through, and it gives off an ATP. ATP and or in a phosphate molecule, and it becomes ADP, adenosine diphosphate. Mm-hmm. And then it gives off another one, it becomes adenosine monophosphate, well, single phosphate. And then it gives off its last phosphate, and it's depleted adenosine. This molecule has no more energy to give. Mm-hmm. And as you go through the day, this is what's happening throughout your body. Your cells are using up their ATPs, including your brain. And your adenosine levels rise. Because the depleted adenosine level. Mm-hmm. And then there's receptors. And as those receptors are stimulated by adenosine, you get the sense of fatigue and tired. I need to sleep. And when you sleep, those adenosines get repackaged by your mitochondria. You wake up with a lot of ATPs and you're ready to roll. Caffeine, one of the things, it does several things, blocks the adenosine receptors.
Wow.
So you're depleting your ATPs. Adenosine is building up. It can't hit the receptor, so you don't get the signal that you're fatigued and tired. You still feel awake and alert.
So your body's missing the signal that it needs to recover. And
this is what's happening. It also does increase some dopamine release, mm-hmm. which can affect alertness and focus mm-hmm. on a synaptic level. But that's not energy. That's more fine-tuning of your focus and attention.
Mm.
It can release dopamine and norepinephrine, which gives that kind of alert and focused mm-hmm. feeling, okay? But that's not actual energy on a cellular level. It also is a vasoconstrictor, so it constricts blood vessels.
Mm-hmm.
And so what will happen is you'll get conditioned, and one cup of coffee is, I'm still tired, so you'll have a second cup.
Mm.
And then you'll notice that again. It might be a third and a fourth, okay? Mm-hmm. And then you'll stop. Somebody else, you'll stop, right? And what happens when you stop? Two things. You'll get bad headaches. Because the vasoconstriction goes away, you get vasodilatation, and you get for a while bad headaches.
Oh, I've experienced that before.
And then you will also get incredible fatigue.
Yeah.
And you'll think, oh, I need, no, the fatigue is you got a backlog of ATPs mm-hmm. that your body's now going to process. If you stay off of it for a week or two, eventually you catch up on all of that. Your system re-regulates, the ATP receptors, the adenosine receptors resensitize, and then your energy levels come back to baseline again.
Yeah.
So that's really what's happening there.
Yeah, I've experienced exactly what you described. And about two years ago or so, I completely stopped caffeine, and I feel more energetic more consistently throughout the day than I ever felt when I was drinking coffee.
And so yeah, what's the data show about that? Are there people who can drink a moderate amount of coffee? Yes, there are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I see coffee more as a medicinal, like a medicine. Okay. And there are places where medicines can benefit depending on the genetic variability of an individual. And there are places where it's going to not be beneficial. And the data shows, though, that I've seen on the large landscape, drinking modest amounts of caffeinated coffee or green tea, only those two caffeine drinks. Anything else with caffeine, every data I've seen, sodas, caffeine pills, caffeine what this, whatever, everything other than these two shows harm.
Hmm.
These two. If there's not a reason, and I'll give you the reasons why, I would say it's a medicinal, have been shown to reduce risk of dementia as you age.
Okay.
Alzheimer's particularly, Alzheimer's dementia, they actually, and it's not the caffeine. Caffeine alone doesn't have any benefit, but in those two drinks, the caffeine interacting with the phytochemicals
mm-hmm.
that are in either the coffee bean or the green tea flavonoids,
mm-hmm.
those two together have a synergy that helps clear amyloid and inflammatory byproducts of metabolism out of the brain and reduce your risk, those two together. Only if it doesn't cause a higher risk or worse problem, meaning physiological normal sleep is better than, and you reduce your risk more than drinking one of these two drinks.
Mm.
If you drink one of these two drinks and can still maintain 7 to 8 hours of normal sleep, then you can add a benefit to yourself. If you drink one of these two drinks and you're now only sleeping, 5-6 hours a night, you're going to actually add risk and your dementia risk go up. So again, it depends on your physiology, your metabolism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. And then green tea has been shown to increase synaptic signaling in 8 different brain circuit regions in all groups, people with dementia have enhanced for the day they drink the green tea, they will have enhanced neural signaling and they'll have enhanced performance, whatever their baseline is.
Wow.
People with mild cognitive impairment will show that. People with no cognitive problems at all, if they drink green tea for the day, they will have enhanced neural signaling in 8 brain regions, and they will also reduce risk of dementia as they age, as long as it's not causing any other physiological problems. One would be the sleep effect.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The other would be if you have a vascular disease, macular degeneration, Raynaud's disease, or other vascular diseases, and you get vasoconstriction that worsens that,
mm-hmm.
that's no good. Seizure disorder, caffeine, lower seizure risk. If you have a seizure disorder and you have your seizures worsen, that's no good. Mm-hmm. So again, I treat it more like a medicinal. Can there be a place somebody may benefit from it? Sure. Will everyone benefit? No. Some people harmed by it. And then the decaf element. The decaf element, so caffeine coffee shows reduced risk of Alzheimer's dementia if it's not causing other problems. Decaf coffee will also reduce all-cause mortality, lower diabetes rates, lower vascular disease rates because of the flavonoids and stuff that are in the coffee bean. So there could be a healthy place to, oh, and the other variable here is black or without sweeteners.
Yes.
Or both.
So, that was on my list.
So if you're using artificial sweeteners, so sugar, just regular sugar. Mm-hmm. If you eat a high sugar diet that's highly inflammatory, that will worsen everything.
Sure.
And what the data shows, a low sugar diet, let's say you really have hardly any added sweets at all in your diet, and you have one cup of coffee or one green tea with 1 teaspoon of sugar, and in a diet that's basically a very, very natural non-sugar diet, that 1 teaspoon a day of added sugar is not enough to have measurable harm.
Okay.
In an otherwise low sugar diet.
Sure.
Okay. If you have a low sugar diet, and you add in 1 artificial sweetener, aspartame and some of these, just 1 a day, that does increase your risk of dementia. It's measurable.
Wow.
Okay.
That's going to be shocking for a lot of viewers.
And then somebody's going to ask about stevia. The data on stevia, it's a natural plant. If it's in a natural form, like just crushed leaves, the data actually shows it also adds anti-inflammatory flavonoids and okay. has benefit. If it's highly processed into white powder, your bets are off. We don't know. It depends on what else has been added, chemicals and other things to it to process it. So I don't know the answer to that question. I would be cautious there. But if it's the natural oil that's just crushed out of the leaf or the leaves themselves, then the data shows it's probably beneficial.
Yeah. And that's really the challenge. We talked about this even with things like CBD earlier. And if it's so ultra processed, or marijuana, we talked about where you said it's so now genetically engineered that the CBD is almost non-existent. And so you don't know what the chemical is that you're getting. It might list stevia, but you don't know if it's the white processed type or if it's the
mm-hmm.
raw,
mm-hmm.
healthier type.
Yeah.
So I'm also anticipating a lot of viewers say, they hear you say, hey, it can be okay to have some green tea or coffee. And they say, great, I'm going to go back to my 3, 4, 5, 6 cups a day. Help us understand what a healthy limit is.
It doesn't interfere with your sleep.
Okay.
Number one, if it's interfering with sleep, it's not healthy. It's not causing other physiological problems. Your blood pressure doesn't go up. You're not having tremulousness mm-hmm. or other things. Okay. So the studies looking just as when they look at black coffee and then risks of other mm-hmm. illnesses, mm-hmm. okay, benefit just to reduce those risks, but they're not actually looking at your sleep and other things like that. Okay.
Yeah.
Up to 4, 5 cups a day. Mm-hmm. It would reduce risk because they're looking at the flavonoids, anti-inflammatory reduction of risk of cardiovascular and diabetes and these types of things. Okay. But if you're interfering with sleep, then that's going to add risk to dementia and stuff. So there's a balance there. Yeah, there's a balance there. Let's just say that.
Yeah. I mean, I know from my experience with atrial fibrillation, AFib, that's...
Caffeine can worsen that.
Caffeine can worsen that. It can be a trigger, like lack of sleep.
That's right.
It can be a trigger, lack of hydration can
that's
be
right.
a trigger. And stress can be a trigger.
And the other thing people need to know is as you get older, your renal functions decrease. That's your kidney's ability to clear. Caffeine is cleared through the kidney. So let's say a person was drinking 3 to 4 cups a day in their 20s, 30s, and mm-hmm. 40s, maybe even in their 50s, not having any sleep problems at all, but they age now. They're late 50s, early 60s, and that's what they've been doing for decades without a problem, but now they're having sleep problems.
And the body's changed.
The body is changing. And so that may be too much caffeine and that's interfering with sleep at night. And simply because they're not clearing it at the same rate they used to. and they need to actually start backing down off of that total caffeine. And if they love their, you know, black coffee and they back down to one, they can only have one day and still sleep well, they can have the decaf, two or three decafs.
Yeah, that's a great solution.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. That's super helpful. So let's switch gears and talk for a moment just about what the Bible teaches us about sleep and the Sabbath and human limitations.
So there's two types of rest that are required for health, to maintain vitality, to be vibrant, to have the abundant life. The physiological rest after you've exerted yourself, spent energy through the day, that is the physiological rest of sleep. That's where your body recovers from it. But God also prescribed a spiritual mental rest, one day in seven, where you come apart and you will sleep part of that 24-hour period, 7 to 8 hours, but the other 16 hours is designed for a weekly decompression, to come apart and set apart the work, the demands, the expectations, and basically go on a mental spiritual vacation. That's what it is. I don't know if you ever go on an actual vacation and you get away. People always say, when I'm on vacation, I just relax. My whole body just lets go, okay? And I just feel more at ease. I don't have to worry about those problems while I'm on vacation. That's what the Sabbath is intended to be, a time where you come apart from all the stresses of the world, whether it's the job for pay and money, whether it's homework assignments, whether it's house cleaning and yard maintenance assignments. The Sabbath is a time for us to be on vacation without guilt. And this is the beauty of it. Many conscientious people who are busy with families, working, they have laundry to do, they have shopping to do, they have the yard to do, they have all this stuff. They don't want to be irresponsible. And so they may go to church in the morning and then they come home and they work the rest of the day because they're responsible people. Mm-hmm. And if they don't do it, they'll feel guilty until they recognize that this is a prescription and gift given to you by God that you can actually come apart and say, no, I'm going to honor God with my spirit temple to maintain my wellness over time. And there is no guilt in taking this day off because this is not the time for that. God has prescribed there's a time for this and a time for that. This is not the time for that. And so when people can make that rest in a mental state, where the Bible is very clear in Isaiah 58, that it must be called a delight. You must enjoy it.
Mm.
Okay, that's the spiritual, uplifting, positive, anti-stress, anti-fear, anti-survival that turns off the whole survival cascade of this world, the rat race of always running to get ahead.
A reset. No,
right, and we come and we have a rest experience in a trust relationship with our Creator.
Mm.
That's lots of science. It physiologically healthy, mentally healthy. Data shows people who do this consistently through their life are much more likely to live into their 100s than those who don't.
Wow.
Okay. Because of this, they're it's a restorative, it's a reset weekly, every week. And so, you know, but if you do that, not from a position of this is a gift and it's a vacation, it's a time to celebrate with family and God, it's a time of delight. If you do it instead of what you might consider, I call the design law. If you do it instead as a rule, God has a rule. He's made up a law. And if you don't, you get in trouble.
Crazy
you get a
dress.
You get a demerit. You're legally going to be punished by the Creator for not observing the rule he set. Then that actually, if you're not doing it, you feel guilty. If you are doing it, then you're constantly worried, am I doing it right? Did I get this done in time? Was it really the Sabbath still hours, not the Sabbath hours? And then your whole day becomes one of fear, hypervigilance, concern, what I can and can't do. There's no joy. And it actually worsens the outcome.
Wow.
Okay, so it is a gift. And so this is where Jesus in the New Testament said, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Think gymnasiums were made for people. People were not made for gymnasiums. Oh, okay, yeah. I don't have to go and use the gym, and I'm not going to get in legal trouble if I don't. I also won't get any strength. I don't have to observe the Sabbath, and God won't be mad at me, won't punish me if I don't. There's no rule that says I have to. It's a gift. It's an opportunity.
But you'll miss a blessing.
You will miss the restorative. You will miss the decompression. You will miss the health benefits. Okay?
Wow.
And that's how it works.
That is powerful, Dr. Jennings. Thank you for sharing. I've never heard it explained that way, but it's incredibly clear and really encouraging, I think, to myself as well as all of our viewers.
Yeah, so sleep, rest, all required for health.
Wow.
Hope you've enjoyed the program today. Thank you for joining us. If you have questions, send those in to questions@designformore.net, questions@designformore.net, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.